Good evening. My name is Peter Berg. I'm head of special collections here in the MSU libraries, and I'd like to welcome you to another evening of the Michigan Writers Series. We're delighted that you can be here. As always, the Michigan Writers Series is generously supported by Schuller Books and Music, and they are here again tonight selling the author's work. So please do stop by and see them as you go out, and I'm sure the writer tonight will be happy to sign any copies that you do buy. The library is a busy place these days. A lot is going on, and there are some other flyers for activities that are happening here in the library on Friday nights, as well as seminars throughout the week. So please do avail yourself of those too if you can come out for them. A lot of nice things are happening here. And now for tonight's writer. Jerry LaFemina is the author of several collections of poetry, including 23 Below, Shattered Hours, Poems 1988 to 1994, and Zarathustra in Love. His latest collection, Graffiti Heart, received the 2001 Anthony Piccione Prize in Poetry from Mammoth Books. Two new collections, The Window Facing Winter by New Issues Press and The Parakeets of Brooklyn, are forthcoming. The latter book won the Bordighera Prize in Poetry and will be published as a bilingual edition. His co-translations with Sinan Toprak of contemporary Turkish poet Ali Yus were published as Voice Lock Puppet in 2001. A noted essayist, fiction writer, and teacher, LaFemina is currently the distinguished poet in residence at Frostburg State University in Maryland, and he serves as the director of the annual Controlled Burn Seminar for Young Writers held at Higgins Lake, Michigan. He received his MFA from Western Michigan University. As is usual with the Michigan Writers Series, our writer will read for about 40 minutes, and then afterwards there'll be a short time for question and answers. Please join me in welcoming Jerry LaFemina.
Thank you, Peter. So, I want to thank the library and Peter and Stephanie for having me here, and my good friend Dennis Heinrichsen and Teresa for, you know, the company and putting up with me, or putting me up, one or the other. And it's always great to be back in Michigan, and it's great to see so many faces that I know. Warms my little black heart. I'm going to start. I sort of have been reading the same poem to begin readings recently and the same poem to end readings recently. And it's sort of like having to play Satisfaction if you're, you know, Keith Richards. This song. Let's say the metaphor for life today is song. Let's say I'm tired of the brash tantrums of punk bands that have defined me to this day. Let's say the sky is a ballet of snow, a cast of flakes choreographed by fronts and the ache of gravity. Shoveling my drive, I almost expect an obscure symphonic piece, a Chaplin soundtrack, perhaps. All the while, the wet, tacky flakes keep falling, but really the only sound is the steady bass of my pulse, the licks of snowmobile engines accelerating past. Let's say I'm alone and cold. Both statements true. Inside, 1,000 albums wait for later. I think of my wife and choose something she will not like. This I know. I choose it for her lips, for the way they press against me so I become Gillespie's trumpet bebopping through the speakers, a car chase of tone and timbre. Let's say I saw him holding one of those trademark horns, the bell bent heavenward, the blue note, New York City, the rhythm section shaking his body, his toes clenched in their shoes, his cheeks blown out and his eyelids choked as if the smoke and light stroked his irises. Let's say music is the only metaphor. Her breath is warm when it blows against my flesh. The song goes giddy, dizzy solos. This is Little Raptors. In the sweep and pitch of sparrows vaulting from the phone lines, suddenly twitching the ancient Adidas pair that sways by knotted laces, I prophesy surprise, a sudden recognition of bird mortality, or a desire to be nothing but the wind wafting under wings. What the young husband must have thought when his wife declared she'd had enough and reversed out of the drive, a kind of denial or humility, some inability to admit she'd gone. And the next morning, when he grumbled the toast he'd made for her breakfast, expectant, 2 hours before, and scattered the crumbs with thrusts of his fists, opening. He stared as sparrows dove like birds of prey, little raptors, and then again just sparrows, simple and hungry. He thought, this is a Eucharist, eat of this flesh. And all this time she drove, the unrolled windows whistling with the turbulence of velocity while the tape player dictated each song. Her car cleft against the wind and gravity. To the west, a ferocity of hawks. People will often say to me, particularly people who are not familiar with contemporary poetry, so often people that I might see at like one of my brother's parties or something like that, I read some of your poems. They don't rhyme. So this is a sonnet variant. It's called Pastoral. Tonight on this farm, miles and decades from our last time together, my comrades are the distant lights of Doylestown and repetitious crickets who fumble over their lines like children rehearsing a school play. Paroled clouds have pilfered the stars, and these roads aren't talking. Nothing recalls that evening, the concert, our contact, how she kissed me goodbye, not goodnight. I became a wire hanger in my clothes. Building by building, Doylestown surrenders to darkness, until this pasture is a closet and her image is a crack of light between door and floor. Actually, what I'd like to say, this is true. I went to my brother's Super Bowl party last year, and a group of his friends were there, and they said, "We didn't know Mike had a brother," to which I said, "I didn't know Mike had friends." And they said, "What does Mike's brother do?" I said, "I write poems." Silence. If I really want to mess them up, I say, "I write prose poems." And so now I'll read some of those. This is the Museum of Pastries. Right, you go to those really fancy schmancy bakeries, and they have those glass cabinets that are backlit, and the pastries are set up, designed flawlessly. She was staring through the glass cases. She seemed to focus on eclairs and the glazed sheen on the cinnamon rolls. I preferred Napoleons and the macaroons with their hint of internationalness. Oh, to be that continental. Meantime, pudgy kids complained, "Why can't I have?" I understood. She must have been their teacher. Her reflection in the pastry cases was delectable, her skin the color of chocolate mousse, its texture too, espresso eyes. I thought of buying her biscotti, a cappuccino, a movie ticket. Just then, a terrorist car bomb exploded early and on the wrong street. The storefront windows shattered, thousands of glass sprinkles drizzling on us all. Screams. Then sirens rose up. I heard the sobbing of school-aged boys. I knew soon there would be questions. On a lighter note, my wife is a poet, Marianne Salmon, and occasionally we say things to each other. Occasionally we say things to each other that the other person wants to use in a poem. And that's okay when the other person doesn't want to use it, but when both of you want to use it, like tug of war. Like each end of this phrase is in one hand. And then there's like negotiation, like I really want this, you know, I'll wash the dog. I'll clean the cat boxes 2 weeks straight, you know. And sometimes then there's just flat out stealing. In this case, Marianne wanted this expression. She had said it. I gave her about 13 hours, I think, and 8 of those she was asleep before I used it. This is early experiments in ingesting fire. I was born in the month of multiple fires and grew up watching my father before the crowds, his neck arched back, hair dangling, veins as if embossed on the tender flesh and his mouth wide. Above him, the baton, its small dollop of blue flame descending until his lips closed around it. I started with marshmallows that got too close to the coals, held them on their sticks like my father. The first touch of the flame like a lover's kiss, not gentle, dangerous, the way he said love ought to be after I asked him about my mother's old leotards, which hung in his closet like snakeskins. The posters of her walking the long wire haunted the small rooms of our bungalow. I knew why he gave it up, reduced to minor gigs at county fairs and festivals, knew too why I lit matches to put in my mouth. I liked the way schoolyard girls smiled and gasped at the same time. Their boyfriends said I was a wuss, called me a freak, which was true, and lit up sheets of loose leaf for me to eat. I blew smoke in their eyes, all of them, and took such inconsequential fire into my mouth. We cremated my mother. No surprise. I watched my father on the love seat every night for weeks afterward, raking his fingers through her ash. Some nights now, I light up shots at a bar, watch the alcohol's brilliant combustion before taking the liquid deep into my belly. I drink for free this way. A waitress once asked me what I would do if something ever went wrong. I said, stop, drop, and roll. I say it to the woman I love, too. Some days I go home and she kisses me hard, but I still can't feel her tongue. Other days she looks just like my mother, though, the way her hair nabs the light as if glittered, the way she walks as if unsure of the ground itself, and I feel, for a brief second, something melting. Not that. It's called Sad Sax. Can I assume you all know who Gomer Pyle is? Okay. Can I assume you all know who Potsy is? From Happy Days? He was like the nerdiest of the nerds on Happy Days. And do you all know who Horseshack was on Welcome Back, Kotter? If not, it just means you have to go watch TV Land. Those are like the cultural references. Sad Sax. Her eyes filled with tears at the sound of his voice. She knew it sounded funny. Jim Neighbors? But still, there was something about the way he said, golly, on Gomer Pyle, USMC, that she found sad, heartbreaking. It was her well of empathy, the same thing that led her to date numerous sad sacks, as her mother called them. lazy bastards was what her dad called them. He'd call up, ask, "Are you still dating that lazy bastard, Nick?" No, she'd sigh. She sighed a lot around her father. "I haven't dated Nick in 2 years. My boyfriend's name is Dave." And of course, Dave was listening from his place on the couch, its cushions molding into the shape of his body. Or it'd be, "No, I haven't dated Nick in 1 year. I'm dating Steve now." And Steve would be in the bathroom ogling the pictures from a Playboy he kept in the towel closet that he thought she didn't know about. Then there was Ben, the stutterer and pathological liar, a bad combination, she knew, and John with eczema and a gambling problem. The list could go on. She avoided dating these days. Her shrink said a moratorium on men might be the best thing for her. "Get to know what you want from a man and from yourself," she had said a few weeks back near the end of a session. Dr. Rivard had been sitting perched like some Freudian gargoyle on her desk, the way she did every appointment. And Nancy had sat in the settee, her legs stretched out, counting the 50 minutes off in her mind. "Write down the attributes of the men you like," Rivard had said. Nancy never found it strange that her doctor had divorced 3 times. Her best friend Lisa had said, "This is the person you go to for relationship advice." Still, she liked Dr. Rivard. It was her lisp. It was the way her knees stuck out when she sat on her desk like she did. Sometimes on her bed, Nancy tried to imitate that position, watching late night cable, the old show station, whatever it was called. She liked Happy Days. Potsy was no nerd to her. And of course, there was Horshack on Welcome Back, Cotter. But her favorite was Gomer, even if she never once mentioned him in the book she kept by the side of her bed, readying for her next session. I'm going to read a couple of prose poems about Clown Baby. I'm a firm believer that clowns are not chosen. It's not a life choice one makes. Clowns are born, which means at any given moment there's a clown baby walking around, crawling around. So there are a whole bunch of clown baby prose poems. And who knows? You know, you don't want to sort of playing with fire, invoking clown baby into a room. All right. And it all started in Traverse City, actually, in the water, looking at the beach and seeing this little tent, little red and white tent. And Marianne said, "What's that?" And I said, "Looks like a little big top." And Marianne said, "What's in it?" And I said, "Must be clown baby." And then we got on shore, and sure enough, there was a baby in the big top. It was something to, like, make sure your child doesn't sunburn at the beach. But by then, clown baby was off and crawling. And so this is the conception of clown baby, because, you know, there has to be an origin myth. Because she wouldn't laugh. Because in the circus tent that summer Saturday, she clapped and ate cotton candy but wouldn't laugh. Because she's scared of clowns, the soul of clown baby came to her. When she made love with her husband that night, she laughed when she came and kept laughing and didn't know why. Clown Baby's Summer. At the beach, Clown Baby comes out of his own miniature tent. Red and white stripes, little big top. He toddles. He hasn't learned the ringmaster's language, and his laughter is an odd barking through red-painted lips. The white of his face is like a moon. He can juggle the sippy cup, bottle, and two breasts. Correction, his face is white like a breast. In a bathing suit, he looks ridiculous, but just see him in a ruffled shirt. Clown Baby's first Halloween. His parents dressed him as a clown. Go figure. Clown Baby and the acquisition of language. When Clown Baby doesn't speak for months, no mama, no papa, no bozo. When Clown Baby doesn't ooh and ah at the trapeze men in black and white tights like flying penguins, his parents begin to worry he might be suffering some horrible birth defect, or worse yet, be a mime. This is Shoes. Once Clown Baby toddled his first steps, his parents happily opted to have his shoes size 9.5 bronzed. When they brought them in, the shoe bronze man said, "Damn, those babies are big. What do you have? Some kind of clown baby?" Clown Baby's parents looked at each other briefly in surprise and mute agreement. They nodded their heads. The shoes were so large there would be extra costs. They took the job ticket, green as a circus ticket, and agreed to come back Tuesday. At home, the house was filled with the slaps of Clown Baby's big feet hitting linoleum as he practiced walking, practiced tumbling, imagined hearing the applause. The poet Jan Beatty and her husband now call each other Clown Baby as a term of, is it affection? I don't know. Hey, Clown Baby, you want to go out tonight for dinner? Poem takes place up in Paradise, Michigan. That's Paradise. Went up to Paradise, Michigan, went to the Red Flannel Inn, which has, you know, a pair of the red flannel bottom long underwear. My mother, good New Yorker that she is, orders the ravioli. The hell? It's like comes with Heinz ketchup on it. Like, get the white fish, the white fish. There's a shipwreck museum up there. I want to have a life wreck museum at one point. I'm going to just bring all my friends over. But anyway, there's a shipwreck museum up there, and Amos Stiles and the information about the USS Independence, which is in the poem, comes from that museum, and it's really actually worth a trip. The barely visible. Lake Superior seems almost still this humid morning, a month without rain, but the water wears a veil of haze, and 8 geese ride the surface toy-like, bobbing, one for each biker in the cabins next door. Their Harleys glistening chrome and waxed paint when we pulled into the parking lot yesterday. All night, they spoke low around a fire pit, passing a bottle of Jack Daniels. I don't want to imagine them telling dirty jokes or faded Easy Rider ripoffs. At dusk, with the four elements, perhaps they thought what I thought, how far north I'd come, and still my suitcase filled with griefs. The geese know, and no matter how much crumpled bread I throw, the large one will still hiss at me like a conscience. Let me now praise Eric Stork, who wet himself in Mrs. Perry's fourth grade class three times, and whom we mocked, even me, who called him friend. How he cried then, standing by his desk, his pants piss-stained, and how he must have cried himself to sleep those long winter days. Never once did I mention this to the priests in their dark confessionals. Never thought it a sin. Mercy to him and to my great aunt Sophie, who survived two husbands, a daughter, a granddaughter, and a great grandson. Her tears saltier than this lake, which is big as an ocean, as deep and wide. Mercy, too, to Amos Stiles, a sailor on the Independence which sank off these shores. Bless his survival, found floating in frigid waves the following day, and how nerve damage left him drowning forever. He couldn't feel his wife kiss him on the cheeks. I want to lift those three high this morning, have their names ascend and dissipate like this haze, like the very notion of God. There are no witnesses, just my flat reflection in the water and the bikers coming out, their muted conversation like vespers. It was the loon, not the goose, the Greeks believed, ferried souls to the next world. What bread I've broken, I've given to these fowl, though, these birds that ascend, frightened when a soul hardly awakens its rider heading west alone into town, I guess. These birds that fly so far in winter only to return to this brown sand. The water's stillness belies its cold and depth. In that way, this lake could be a soul. In a few hours, white caps will wash the beach, and the haze will dissolve, revealing the barely visible shore of Canada like another world we know is there, but can't yet visit. And because it's almost baseball weather out there, this is the Duff. The plainest girl in eighth grade, Judy Wagner, watched from across the street as we played baseball in the cemetery courtyard, watched from the place her father worked, selling gravestones and shaving names into buffed marble and granite. Such proximity to death intrigued us, although as we walked toward infield positions after another failed scoring chance, other names lingered offshore from our lips, names almost strung from our tongues to dreams that woke us aching. We'd pitch innings among ourselves, six-on-six games with only two outfielders, the long wrought iron fence behind them, and behind that, over 1,000 strangers who'd been reduced to names and dates. Thus, my childhood is already a type of death. The sun, those July afternoons, resplendent as the god we learned from nuns the 9 months of St. Rock's school each year, even as in our minds we committed adultery, which was nothing, which we had to tell Father Gannon in his dour cubicle, admitting we had impure thoughts, that we fought with our friends over which was better, the Yanks or Mets, and tore faded ball caps from one another's heads for sets of keep away, and that we teased poor Judy over her father's macabre job. It was just work. It paid tuition and for the plaid jumpers the girls wore. We said our Hail Marys, the same dull penance for our same dull sins. So imagine his surprise, which I couldn't see because of the thin screen between us, when I sought absolution for murder. I wasn't confused. See, I'd killed a dove in a freak collision of trajectory and velocity. I could have done the math to show you in Sister Marcella's class. One hard-line drive striving to land among the graves of immigrants meets a white bird swooping from who knows where. An astonishment of feathers. bird and ball fallen. Jimmy Royal caught the bloodstained sphere to call me out. We stood, some with mitts dangling limp, staring as the small thing throbbed a few more times, then stopped. What could we do? We played on, avoiding that place in the outfield, and I circumnavigated a rosary as punishment for my remorse, each bead in my fingers hard and small as a beak. Next game, it was gone, but Judy was still there. Judy, who took my hand one autumn morning on the bus, even though we hardly ever spoke, and held it in hers so they seemed like two wings folded at rest. She didn't say a word as the bus swayed and bounced toward school, where already we were studying the countless species of grief. Now some poems from this new book. From Clown Baby to Alexander Baby, a poem called Elegy with Small Steps. Alex, at 11 months, has become a drunken munchkin, balancing himself against the coffee table, then staggering forward. Curiosity intoxicates him, the world unwrapped each day, a gift of familiar laws and family. Tomorrow, the rocking chair will still rock, and he'll push it and smile, his joy simple. Words still hide in his memory of images. The world outside his window summons astonished stares, or it summons laughs, big and happy like Bill, who died last week, newly 24. Fuck justice or reason, people die. We worked the bar together, sparred with drunk teens, and he picked up Alex one summer evening with hands half my boy's size, said, I'm a rocket to the moon, up overhead, down, up again, until their mouths both became spigots of giggles. A car crash Thursday night. DOA. I know it's cliche, but the curses are useless and beautiful and natural. Accidents. The skid of a car, its brakes locked, an autumn night. The rubber-necking trees said nothing. Fuck justice or reason. In the morning, the rocking chair is still rocking, rocking not like a cradle nor a church bell after the waning note's been struck, but rocking like some ship 4 centuries ago, loaded with hope for the new world. Called Empties. That last poem, I worked as a bouncer when I was in grad school. And Bill Gecker, I worked with there, was one of the other bouncers who died. This is another poem that takes place from those moments as a bouncer, about 14 months of my life, called Empties. And two Chrises appear in this poem. I still enjoy this night, a storm forming to the east and me with a porch seat. I still forget sometimes that I don't need to leave at 10 for the club and the inevitable clash with some drunk whose mouth is louder than the crash of guitars and bass and cymbals. I still like my music loud, although some nights I miss the brash pogo stick of conversation with waitresses and regulars. And after I wheeled out the trash, after the empties had been stacked and the cooler filled with Millers, I'd sit with a 12-ounce, my body unstable and stuttering on a bar stool as I stared through the picture window like a failed clairvoyant. and of two friends I worked with then. Who knows? Chris Lee, with his ivy of violet braids, the tattoo of a teddy bear clutching a machine gun on his arm, and his exhibitionist fables, always another woman, and the other Chris, for whom fear was a racist cop who enjoyed his food and his dope almost as much as he loved to laugh, that deep eruption emanating from his bone girders outward to his 280-pound girth. I still see them some nights, the same way I'd see their reflections after closing, standing behind me at the Starfighter game, and beyond them, the bartender vending one last illegal shot to the sound man, a band breaking down in the distance. The rain still fills the potholes on Michigan Ave, the wet tarmac stretching stolen light of street lamps the length of a block. I still like my music loud. And in bars all over America, punk rock kids are plugging Stratocasters into patchwork amplifiers. It makes me happy, this rain, but it reminds me of Big Chris, who stripped his shirt one night and stood in the street singing what we couldn't hear. He started soaping himself with the night. Rain filled his near-empty bottle, and soon he sipped big and frowned as if suddenly he knew his future and it frightened him. Then he ran off, his body slick and brilliant with perspiration and rain, so he almost shined like obsidian, while Chris Lee and I stayed by the window, our hair shivering. Shit, he said, not as an expletive, but as a defeated act of vocabulary, his inability to choose a different word. I still like my music loud. I still like storms like this one, all the rain close to home, all the lightning miles away, so there's no thunder, no sound at all, but for the sanitizing drum roll of the shower on the roof and the tread of loud individual drops which strike the soft earth, setting what it holds free. Two more poems. It's called Lines About Longing and Roofs. June, in the shade of television in 10A, a McDougal Street walk-up, the roof's tar still tacky with daylight, their bodies possessed with the fallen angels of rhythm and melody, which they celebrate 8 stories above asphalt, the sensual hymn of muscles extending, flexing. Pausing, they watch flies tango in the dank air of their sweat, the atmosphere of their flesh damp with dance. Come morning, she wants to see the shower spray flamenco on the ballroom of his belly and back. When he steps from behind the curtain, she'll stand ready as an exorcist, holding a towel stolen from one of the rooms where they squandered their 1,000 nights. The first poem began with Dizzy Gillespie, and the last poem ends with some Dizzy Gillespie in there. It's an elegy for the poet William Matthews, who was a dear friend of mine. Elegy for William Matthews. On television, one of those shows with angels who have nothing better to do than help us humans out. And in the store, angel figurines, some plucking harp strings and some blowing celestial trumpets. I can't help but think of Gillespie then. Can't help but think of Miles. Really, though, I think of Matthews in his Upper West Side apartment with a record spinning, followed by another. The whole time he was discussing one poem or poet, but occasionally he'd stop and point something else out, a particular riff maybe, or the vibraphone player, the rhythm section. If I could write now, I'd apologize for the hokey angels that began this poem, but he'd probably forgive me for them. I hadn't realized the last time we'd talked, a phone call about meeting for drinks in late November when I'd be in New York next, would be the last time we talked. That's the funny thing about death for those of us left here with our horns still wailing. The first time we met, he drew a wine glass above his signature in foreseeable futures. And when I mourned for him that long December, I read his books as if for the first time, delighting in their sounds and caesuras. Now, years later, I've been celebrating his kindnesses with an editor, glasses of wine raised, deep red in the light. I'd like to think the slight beat of glass against glass is a sound he loved or at least enjoyed. Back at home, I spin a record in his honor. Gillespie blows, swing low, sweet Cadillac. Thank you all very much. I guess I'm supposed to take some questions now. So I'll take them if you got them. I'm currently at Frostburg State University in Maryland, which is in northwestern Maryland, right in the sort of area where West Virginia and Pennsylvania and Maryland are all sort of hanging out in the same, like 10 square miles, and at about 3,000 feet, which is great in the winter. Yeah. That was a geography question. Other questions?
What's your connections in Michigan other than going to school at Western?
I went to school at Western, and then I taught at Kirtland College in Roscommon for 9 years. And still direct the Control Burn Seminar for Young Writers every year on Higgins Lake. So I spent a third of my life in Michigan. So I like to think it's a pretty firm connection. Plus, I married a Michigander, so that makes me like an honorary Michigander, I think. It's sort of like citizenship, you know, if you marry an American, you become an American, so... it is the best week of my life every year. It's a giant sleep deprivation program, actually, and we actually bring psychologists out from all over the state to just watch the kids. It's a week-long program for 15 to 20-year-old writers, and it's held not at a school, and it's 6 hours a day of workshops in either fiction or poetry, and then readings every night. There's social time, but there's also computer labs. Most of them have homework every night, and they do it, and they produce some really great poems and stories. And the classes are held small. They max out at 7 students, so that there's a lot of face time, a lot of one-on-one time, and really hard to sort of not do the work. You know, people are always aware of what's going on, and if you try to sleep late, I come and wake you up, which people don't like. I've been known to come in with one of my son's super soakers and open doors and just start shooting into the bed until people wake up. But it's a great program, and we have great keynotes every year. We've had Charles Baxter as a fiction keynote. We've had Judith Minty as a poetry keynote. We've had Reg McKnight as a fiction keynote. This year we have John Smolens as our fiction keynote, and Kathy Fagan from Ohio State University as our poetry keynote. It's always a great time, it's the eighth year for the program. There's at least one seminar alum here tonight, whom I won't sort of pick out, but that sort of warms my heart. And I still hear from seminar students who've graduated years ago. It's a close-knit bonding sort of experience. It's also a giant sleep deprivation program, though, as it turns out, because the students don't sleep, and they're often doing homework for the other classes, too. Like, someone will say, oh, well, Jerry gave me this assignment. They'll go, oh, I could do that. And so they end up doing 2 classes worth of work. The Astoria Bakery in Greektown actually inspired it, because it is set up like a museum. Like, wow, don't Don't tap the glass. Don't touch the pastries. But I got stuck in that poem. I sort of set up this really wonderful scene, and I was stuck. And I read a newspaper story in which, you know, some terrorist bomb blew up too soon. You know, like, oh, it was just parked out in front of the, you know, in front of my sister's house. And I went in to, have my last dinner, and the car blew. And I thought, well, what would happen in this? But then it couldn't just be about that. I really wanted to sort of implicate the speaker in that somehow, which is where the last line comes from. I knew soon there'd be questions. And for a long time after September 11th, I felt like I wasn't allowed to read that anymore. And it's still only in certain audiences where I feel like I can read it and where I feel it'll go over and not, dare I say it, bomb. But I felt like I could do this here. One of those really strange synchronous events that happened when I moved up to Kirtland, when I moved up to Roscommon and started teaching at Kirtland, the professor of political science there, a fellow named Sinan Toprak, is a Turkish, native-born Turk, who came to this country in his late 20s. And Sinan and I became fast friends, but he was also this lover of poetry and had all these books of Turkish poetry. As it turns out, I was terrible as a language student, but I took a linguistics class which required us to live for several months with a native-speaking family and a non-English-speaking native-speaking family. And I ended up living, most people lived with like cousins or aunts or something, but I ended up living with a friend of mine and her mother who were from Turkey. And so they spoke Turkish in the house, and so I was the one language where I could actually hear it familiarly. So it sort of worked that we could do this project, and that's how it sort of happened. And then when we had about, I don't know, maybe 80 translations done, we sort of weeded through the ones that were actually bearable, which got us to about 60. And then we sort of pared it down to the best of about 45 of those. And then we sent them to Ali Uje, who's still alive and who had taught English, but he didn't really speak English that well. And he gave the manuscript to a friend of his who taught in England for several years. And once we were given the okay by Ali Uje, we sort of felt like we could publish the book that he thought he liked them. And so we were pretty happy with them. Although I did this translation conference last year, this guy who was translating contemporary Turkish poetry said that we took way too many liberties and that the poems didn't have the Turkish Eda. I said the poet approved these. So, you know, I don't care what Mr. UJ says. I'm like, well, okay, I do. everybody has their political agenda. Ali Uje is a very political poet, there's a lot of political infighting in Turkish literature among those who are willing to be part of the opposition and those who aren't. And I think a lot of the sort of problems I had with this fellow were based more on the politics of UJ's poems than the translations themselves. Thank you.